Going off the clock. Turn to chapter 10. Chapter 10. We got to get through three chapters tonight. We got it. Well, I believe. Now, I was going to say, now that, yes. Now, that's
move from the left hand to the right hand. That's the first move up higher.
No. All right. Need a brother to lead us in prayer to get started. Who wants to do that? Anthony, thank you.
Heavenly Father, thank you for your blessings. Thank you for your mercy. Thank you for all that you have done for us. We ask that you would be with us, dear Father, and study your word. Be with Jeff. Bring to his remembrance those things that he has studied. Help us to understand your word and be able to apply it to our everyday life. Be with us, guide us, and strengthen us is our prayer through Jesus' name.
All right, so past couple of weeks, we looked at the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' message that expresses the essence of the kingdom that he is bringing, and how to live a kingdom life. That led to where we were last week, a couple of chapters of him beginning to proclaim and act out the kingdom on earth and the works that he did as the Messiah, showing that the kingdom is here with, you know, that he's bringing the kingdom with him and that he is the Messiah. At the very end of chapter 9, we find a setup for the next thing. Remember what we talked about early in the quarter when we talked about how Matthew does things. He alternates sections of Jesus' teaching and then actions, sections of narrative where the essence of that teaching is carried out or in some way enacted, okay? And so Sermon on the Mount led to, you know, chapters 8 and 9 that we looked at last week, the early actions of the kingdom as Jesus begins there in Galilee to spread the good news. But at the very end of that, after he has done this, and there's this early success and attention, the very end, chapter 9, verse 37 to 38, he says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly." The adverb matters. This is, you know, if you're in on God's kingdom, what should you be praying for? Thy kingdom come. Didn't he just pray that way? So what are you praying earnestly? Man, the Lord, you know, that the Lord of harvest sends out laborers into the harvest. Now, what's the very next thing that happens in chapter 10?
He sends them out.
Yeah, exactly. He's not now just doing it by himself. He is taking 12. Is that a significant number? Yeah, first time in Matthew's gospel, we have the 12 assembled. Different gospel writers kind of bring out the assembling of the 12 in different ways. And so, at the beginning of chapter 10, he called to him his 12 disciples, gave them authority. Oh, there's one of those big words in Matthew. Authority over unclean spirits that cast them out and heal every disease and affliction. Where has Jesus been doing that? The past two chapters. What's he been doing? What did we look at last week? He's healing diseases. He's casting out demons. The harvest is greater than one man, even Jesus, because he's still in human form, can do. So I will send out my 12 representative of his people, the number of his people, to do likewise. And the names of the 12, and then we have the names of the 12. The order in the lists varies between gospel writers, but one thing that the lists always do, Peter always comes first, Judas always comes last, and you know why. One of the interesting things, and I think all of us know this, but when you look at the 12 that he assembles, it is a mix of small businessmen, government agents, political lunatics, and Judas. No, seriously, that's what we call it today, right? I mean, you know, what is Matthew? He's an IRS agent. A corrupt, probably corrupt IRS agent.
Well, they got percentages. So.
Oh, that's what I'm saying, which means, yeah, exactly.
They were incentive.
What were Peter and Andrew, James and John? Small business owners. So they were men of some means, and they had responsibility. What's Simon the Zealot?
He's a rebellious person who wants to overthrow the ruling power.
He's your friend who wants Texas to secede. That's who he is. Okay? He's the guy who won't shut up about politics. What a mess. What a mix. And that's who Jesus calls out. And of course, I think all of us heard enough sermons. We understand the lessons that come from the 12 he assembled. We got to keep moving. So then comes the speech. Chapter 10 is in this second major cycle in Matthew's gospel. The rest of the chapter is the speech. Chapters 11 and 12 will be the action that comes out of the teaching, right? That's our pattern in Matthew's gospel. So let's look at the teaching. The teaching this time has to do with the mission of the 12. And so here's you know, there's different ways you can outline it, but here's a fairly effective way I think you outline it. Verses 5 to 15 are the basic instructions to the 12. He sent them out, instructed them, go nowhere among the Gentiles, enter no town of the Samaritans. What is he, Jesus? Is he a bigot? Is he a Jewish nationalist? Why? Because how does... Yeah. He's got a promise to keep with Abraham, and the blessing to the Gentiles comes through the Jews, not in spite of the Jews. And so, you know, and you'll see this pattern all the way to the book of Acts, right? How does the gospel start? And in Luke, the Gentile even emphasizes this in Acts chapter 1, Acts chapter 2. From Jerusalem to Samaria, Judea and Samaria to the ends of the earth. So at this point in the story, remember, geographically, Jesus' ministry has been limited by and large to Galilee at this point. Even within the Jews, he's on the edge of the map, right? You know, he's starting the big city, he starts on the edge. Even for the Jews. So go nowhere among the Gentiles and are no town of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and proclaim as you go, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. What did John the Baptist say when he first shows up? What does Jesus say when he first starts his messianic ministry? What do his disciples now say as they start their ministry? See the message? And what should you do if you understand the kingdom of heaven is at hand? Repent. Get your life in order. That's what you need to be doing. All right. So he gives them, you know, that's all essentially a one-sentence summary of the essence of the message. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse lepers, cast out demons. Has Jesus himself done all that so far? Yes. What are they to do? Go and do likewise. You received without paying, give without pay. What does he mean? You didn't have to pay Jesus for his teaching. This was a tuition-free, life-changing university course. They didn't have to pay Jesus for his teaching. Should they, therefore... be, you'll sign up online for my 12-week course. No, they need to give it freely as well. So give without pay. Yeah.
I took that to mean that they got the power to do it freely.
Sure.
And so they should give it.
Sure. Freely. But bottom line is all of it is not to be charged. There's no price tag on it. Right. Acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey, or two tunics or sandal or staff, for the laborer deserves his food. You don't demand money for what you do, but from those who receive it and are thankful, can you accept some food, some shelter? Yes, you can. You don't, you know, we don't sit there and say, if you don't pay, I don't talk. But for those who receive and understand the gift they have been given, it would be natural to say, what can I do? And there... you know, you're able to take what you can. So they are not to be prepared, you know, to make huge preparations. Why? There's a sense of urgency. And whatever town or village you enter, find out who is worthy in it. Stay there until you depart. As you enter the house, greet it. If the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. If not worthy, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house. Why? Verse 15, there's a sense of urgency. I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah than for that town. Why? Because God himself never came to Sodom and Gomorrah. Who's come to the Jews? God himself. So, you know, to whom much is given? Much is demanded, much is expected. That's right. All right, now verses 16 to 23. Now what he does is he gives them more instructions on what to expect as they do this, okay? Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Let me give you some training for what you're going to face when you do this. And what's the whole sense of being wise as serpent, harmless as doves?
Smart, but not.
Yeah. So here's the thing that we miss sometimes. You know, sometimes people, we'll read stuff like, you know, turn the other cheek and stuff like that, and think, therefore, Christians are doormats. Now listen, is there a time and a place when you confess Jesus and take the consequences? Yes. But did even Jesus sometimes, because it was not his hour, as he'd say in a different gospel, because it was not his hour, would he dodge the consequences sometimes? Yes. Jesus does not expect us to be fools. Part of being wise, ironically, is knowing the time to stand your ground and knowing the time when it's not worth provoking the conflict. Does he want them staying in town until they are crucified or stoned?
No.
No. Why? Because if that happens to him, what can't happen? Yeah, exactly. So you give a town a chance. If you receive, teach. If you're not, do what? Yeah, you're not supposed to stand there until they kill you. You've got another town to go see. Keep moving. Beware of men, for they will deliver you over the courts. They will flog you in their synagogues. You will be dragged before governors and kings for my sake to bear witness before them and the Gentiles. In other words, that day is going to come. That day is not today. Because will these 12 men eventually stand in the Gentile world? Yeah, they will. Yeah, they will. When they do deliver you over, do not be anxious how you are to speak or what you are to say, for what you are to say will be given to you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of the Father speaking through you. The 12 are going to be inspired men when the time comes. Brother will deliver brother over to death, father his child, children will rise up against parents and have them put to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. That verse matters because that verse is basically setting us up for what chapters 11 and 12 are going to be. Okay? 11 and 12 are going to be the enactment of that verse, where the opposition to Jesus himself, because one point he's about to make here as we keep reading is, basically, you know, if they've done it to you, they'll do it to me. A servant is not greater than his master. And so what chapters 11 and 12 are going to show is that Jesus is going to hit that exact roadblock, and he's going to be hated irrationally. He's going to ask good questions. They're not going to have answers they want to give to his good questions. And so what do you do when you can't outreason your opponent? You get angry and use the power at your disposal against your opponent. That's what you do. And that's what Jesus is going to begin to encounter in chapters 11 and 12. Verse 22 sets up the next two chapters of the action. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. The one who endures me will be saved. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next, for truly I say to you, you will not go through all Israel before the Son of Man comes. You don't have time to linger. Urgency. We got more to do in the Messianic mission before I'm crucified. Make your rounds. Spread the news. Keep moving. All right. Verses 24 through 42, the end of the chapter, the rest of the chapter. Now is basically talking about the essence of discipleship. You know, what are they to be? He's trained them about what they're going to face. What are they to be? Who are they to be? And that's what starts here. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. Okay? Your goal is not to exceed me. Most students want to exceed you. You know what every doctoral student wants to do to his advisor someday? Write the more important book than his advisor did. You know, in the ancient world, your goal was to become like your master, not to surpass him. And so what's Jesus saying that they need to do? Is their goal to write a better book or preach a better message than him? No. Their job is to become like him in every respect. It is enough for the disciple to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. By the way, that means if they have called the master of the house Beelzebul, and guess what we're going to see in the story next chapter? You know what they're going to say about Jesus? He does this by the power of Beelzebul. By the way, for those who are wondering, that's actually two words in the Semitic language. It's just slammed together in Greek and in English. The Baal part, that's Baal. And Baal just means a master or a lord. Became capital B for a god. Just means master or lord. Lord of flies, lord of dirt. It was a Jewish euphemism for Satan. So basically, by the power of Satan, you do this. So if they do that to me, how much... if they call the master of the house Beelzebul, well, how much more will they malign those of his household? Buckle up, guys. And you're going to have to learn to take it. Christians cannot be afraid of false accusation and slander. It comes with the territory if you're doing it right. So, and I want you to notice in this next section, from 26 to 31, that's the next section of his instruction in discipleship. What's the key word in this section? The key word is fear. He starts with, so have no fear of them. Why? Not because they have no power. There's not because they can't hurt you, because they can. That's why you shouldn't be afraid. The reason you should not be afraid of them is for nothing is covered that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. What does he mean by that? How is that meant to comfort somebody? I'd rather them not have power over me. I'd rather them not be able to hurt me personally if I'm being told don't be afraid.
They'll be exposed ultimately in the last day.
That's it. At the end of the day, they will be exposed for who they are. And what does that mean about your being exposed? What will you be shown to be in the last day? Faithful. And God's friend and the one who was right. And for people who are focused on eternity, that actually should matter. Because here's the thing. Even if they don't kill you, are you still going to die? Yeah. See, now you can understand the logic of why Jesus says what he says next. Going down to verse 28. And do not fear those who can kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. See, even if they can kill you, that's not real power. Why? Why is that? I mean,
Soul's going to live forever.
Yeah. The real power is not killing. Because here's the thing. Even if they don't kill you, are you still going to die?
Yeah.
So one way or other, is life going to end, whether it ends abruptly or ends, in old age? Is that going to happen?
Yeah.
So why be afraid of that? Right? Why be afraid? Whether you live to write your memoirs at 105 or whether they stone you at 37, either way, where are you? Dead. It's simply for the person who gets the real power is not the power to command or decree death. The real power is to give life. Because no man can do that. Anybody can kill. It's easy to kill. To be crass. It's easy to kill. Anybody can do it. Under the right circumstances. To give life. And so don't be afraid of it. They have no power. It feels that way and seems that way. So they have no power. If that's the worst they can do you, they have no power. So again, why not be afraid? Because in the last day, what's going to happen? Everything's going to be exposed. And the template of God's justice and God's righteousness is going to be laid over what's happened, not the world's counterfeit. And they're going to be shown to be dead wrong, damnably wrong. And you're going to be shown to have been right all along. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. And again, going on to comfort, the verse 29, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them fall to the ground apart from your father? Even when you suffer, by the way, what has he told them earlier in the chapter? Are they going to suffer in some forms? They are going to suffer. Even when you suffer, does God not know? What's he reminding them? Of course God knows. If he sees the sparrow fall, what does he know about what's going on in your life? All of it. Even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So fear not, therefore, for you are more valued than many sparrows. You matter to God. And your suffering is not a mark of the fact that God doesn't care or God doesn't know. Boy, we've got to work on getting that to be our routine way of thinking. How often do we sin simply because we're afraid, if we're really honest? Then we peel back the levels of the onion. Get down to brass tacks. Because we're afraid. Yeah. We compromise at work because we're afraid to lose our job because we won't eat. Or we'll have somewhere to live. We're afraid to stand up for what's right because we don't want to lose a friendship, even a friendship with a family member. Is Jesus going there in just a minute? Yeah, he is. Think about how much sin comes from fear. Specific sins, but underneath it, fear. Fear of loss, fear of suffering, fear of pain. And what does Jesus say to his disciples for all of it? If you're going to be my disciple capable of working kingdom work in this world, can you be fearful? No. And by the way, so when you get to the book of Revelation, what is John told is the first in the list of those who go to the lake of fire?
Fearful.
Yeah, depending on your translation, the cowardly, the fearful. They're the first in. Well, the adulterers and the sodomites will get theirs too, but who's the first in that list? Because what's Jesus been saying? What did he say in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6? Do not be anxious or fearful, basically. A lot of sin comes out of fear. We can do a whole quarter on that. I'll stop and think about it. Maybe we should submit something. I'll say something again. All right. So there it is. All right. Verse 32. So, everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father's in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father in heaven. Why does he have to say that? Because what's he just got through saying? Don't be afraid. What's the most basic reason why most people deny Jesus when they know better? What does the Gospels make clear even about Peter when he denies Jesus? Why does he do it? He's
fearful.
What would Peter have told you a week before? Never me. Fear leads to a lot of sin. And so Jesus has warned the disciple who will serve him in this life, which is what this part of chapter 10 is about. You got to get over your fear. Do not think that I have come to bring peace to earth. And again, think about what he's saying here. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. Yes, it's good news, and yes, the gospel can bring peace, but in reality, as you preach the gospel of the kingdom, setting up 11 and 12, where Jesus is going to run into a brick wall, the message will lead to opposition. Jesus knows that the message of the kingdom will create conflict. That's what he means when he says, I didn't come to bring peace, but to bring a sword. To tell the rebellious world these are God's terms for surrender, the world will not take well. And so I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A person's enemies will be those even of his own household. It's not just, you know, your denominational friend or neighbor is going to get really, really offended when you don't think they're saved. Like the Pharisees get offended when they don't think they're saved. It's going to be even in your own family. Tension between parents, children, in-laws and outlaws. All the rest of it. And whoever loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life, put the parentheses, in this life. In other words, you're too tightly tied to the continuance of life and the comfort of life itself is not worthy of me. But whoever loses life for my sake will. And doing what I've done over the years, I've learned, especially when you look at all the things Jesus could say as he's prepping his disciples. He's telling them to be prepared to lose their families over this. One of the things I've noticed about Christians is there's going to be a lot of people who go to hell because of family. Parents who change their views about divorce and remarriage once one of their kids is caught up in a mess. And on it goes. I mean, why did Jesus say this? Because Jesus knows there's going to be a lot of people who'd rather keep Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving comfortable than live in the truth and tell the truth. Lose relationships, potentially. Compromise on things that cannot be compromised on. And fall into hell. He starts by telling his own disciples, listen, you do this job, your own family may well turn against you. I have no idea. No, James and John, sons of Zebedee. We have no idea how Zebedee reacted to what his sons were up to. Maybe that's what he was talking about. Maybe James and John paid a high price with that. Is Jesus going to demonstrate in his own family? In chapters 11 and 12, guess what Jesus' own family is going to do? Yeah. How hard must it have been for Mary, knowing who her son was, but watching her other children turn on him? Think about that. What must Passover have been like for them? What Jesus is looking for here, and this is a key, this is going to set us up to chapters 11 and 12. He's going to set us up in key, set a little bit of what we were talking about last week. Remember in Matthew chapter 9, when Jesus quote from Hosea 6, and when we realize that word mercy is not what we usually mean, and it's really what Hosea meant in the original context, it's just because the Septuagint, that if you follow it, we get the wrong idea. Hesed is loyalty in this context. What is Jesus saying here in this? What can you summarize that entire section we just read there about what Jesus is looking for in the disciple, especially from verse 26 down? What's he looking for in a word? He's looking for loyalty above all. That's what he's looking for. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Do you want to
You raise a good point about fear breeding sin.
Oh, absolutely.
Because even Peter did it when he was fearful, he lied. And God even says he hates liars.
Oh,
and that's one of the things he needs that will have that part of the lake.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Turn the page. We've got to move on. You get the idea of the essence of what he was telling his disciples. Strong stuff. Now watch it enacted for Jesus himself. Because again, if they've done it to me, they'll do it to you. And when he says, a servant's not greater than his master, part of Jesus' point is, I go first in this. Jesus is not asking of us anything that he himself did not encounter. Yes, ma'am.
When he's before Pilate.
Sure.
They said, you don't have any authority unless it's given
correct
from heaven.
That's exactly right. All right, so here we go. Chapter 11. And now what we just read in his teaching, watch it pop up for him. He's going to demonstrate to his disciples exactly what it is and how you overcome it and push back on it and live through it. Okay? So chapter 11. And there's going to be, so chapters 11 and 12 kind of fit together. Both chapters are all the actions associated with that teaching that he just brought. And literally the movement overall through these couple of chapters, it starts with gentle concern from John. Are you the one or are we looking for another? But John's not really rebellious. John's confused. But still, pushback. It starts with the mild pushback of the confused to the planning violence opposition of the truly rebellious. Okay? So it literally starts gentle, moves to firm, and then plotting violence. That's how it works. So we start with John. When Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in their cities. So the 12 are out doing their thing, but what does Jesus do in the meantime? Carries on. And so, when John heard in prison about the deeds of Christ, and most of us are familiar with this story, two things happen. Number one, Jesus sends back a solid response. Go and tell John, verse 4, what you see and hear. Blind receive their sight, lame walk, lepers cleansed, and so on and so forth. All things that the prophets foretold, not just what he's done, but the prophets foretold this would be the Messiah. So he says, look, man, am I doing what Isaiah and the rest talked about? The answer is yes, which is why he adds at the end in verse 6, and blessed is the one who is not offended by me. Can you get over the fact that I'm not doing what the prophet said in the way you thought I would do what the prophet said? Because they thought the Messiah was going to do what the prophet said in a way that leads to the overthrow of Rome as well. Yes, they'd get this plus revolution. And he's doing this and no revolution. In fact, he's doing this in Galilee, not Jerusalem. And so, blessers are not, and that's going to be the essence. At the end of the day, there is something about Jesus that everybody has to get over. Whatever your cultural baggage, your previous religious upbringing, the challenges in your life where you wish Jesus, had said something that something otherwise than he did, so your life wouldn't be as difficult as it is, as you try to walk the straight and narrow. Everybody's got something they wish Jesus was different about. I don't care who you are. If you're reading the book, listening to what he says, and trying to conform your life to it, everybody's got something from Jesus that's hard to hear and hard to live. And what Jesus is saying is pertinent here. At the end of the day, can you get over who I actually am, not who you wish I was? Having dispatched John's concern, then he says to those who were with him as he went, he began to speak to the crowd concerning John. Listen, don't think John's a bad guy. He's legit. After all, you guys were following him before you followed me. What'd you go out to the wilderness to have a look at, right? He was doing something serious. And I'll tell you who John is. He is a prophet, absolutely. He is the one that Isaiah foretold as coming as the herald of God himself coming from Isaiah chapter 40. And truly I say to you, among those born of women, there has arose no one greater than John the Baptist. Why could he say that? Because even Moses did not herald the coming of the Lord with the kingdom. Even Moses brought a covenant. Moses was great. But John is the prophet who literally got to walk before God himself and say, the kingdom has come, or is coming. This is it. Even Moses didn't get to do that. Moses said, we got to take a walk to a land. No greater prophet than John, Jesus says, because he got the greatest honor of all the prophets, to literally be the herald of God himself. But the one who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. That's how great the kingdom is. From the days of John until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. People want into the kingdom on their own terms. That's why you can't be offended of who I am and how I'm, the kind of Messiah I actually am, the kind of kingdom I'm actually offering you. People would rather help Jesus rewrite the script, like Peter will offer to do on a couple of occasions. People want to literally, violently, forcibly change who he is, what he's doing, and what the kingdom is. all right, verse 16, moving on. So verse 16. But what shall I like in this generation? It's like children sitting in the marketplace calling their playmates. We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not mourn. For John came neither eating nor drinking. They said, John's got a demon. Son of man came eating and drinking. They say, look at him. He's a glutton, a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by our deeds. He says, look, here's the bottom line. The truth of the matter is, you guys are never satisfied no matter how it comes. When John comes, you know, living a very pious, simple, monastic life, what do you say? He's got a demon, which is also back in their culture a way of just saying you're nuts. You're nuts. You're out of your mind. You're insane. And so, literally, you know, John was nuts for living like that. So Jesus comes and does the opposite. He lives in the mainstream, and they say, yeah, he's a mess. Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds. Wait and see how the outcome is. Let's see how the story ends before we decide that. And so, but what all this comes back to is at the end of the day, they reject whatever does not meet their expectations. That's still, that whole little bit is still in that same spirit. Do you see that? You get that? We reject whatever is not, you know, doesn't meet our standards, and so we criticize it. We reject it. Verse 20. So then he begins to, you know, again, criticize those who have gotten the miracles so far. Woe to you, Chorazin, Bethsaida. These are all Galilean cities where he's gone. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. In the Old Testament, what are Tyre and Sidon famous for? Decadent wealth and Baal.
Selling idols.
Rampant, you know, the idolatry that became the corruption of Israel. And yet Tyre and Sidon would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes if they had gotten it. And you, Capernaum, verse 3, will you be exalted to heaven? No, you'll be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom, we all know all about that place, it would have remained until this day. Those they would have repented and not been destroyed. But I tell you, it'll be more tolerable in the day of judgment for the land of Sodom. And Jesus then declared, and this is an important thing he says now in this context, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding. Now, when he says wise and understanding, what does he mean?
Those who think they're wise.
Yeah, the worldly wise. In other words, guys like the Pharisees who are about to show back up in chapter 12 as the pushback intensifies. The worldly wise. Okay, so what he's saying is setting up an example of exactly what he's talking about. That chapter breaks, as always, in the wrong place. What he's saying here at the end of 11 is setting up what's about to happen. And so he gives thanks to God that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children, which sometimes is little in the gospel, but little children in Matthew's gospel, or those who are little in general, are those who are naive, simple, at least in their own eyes. Might be very accomplished and powerful and even rich, but in your own eyes, you still see yourself as somebody who can learn from, you know, maybe God made flesh. For such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father. No one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone the Son chooses to reveal to him. So only those who listen to Jesus are going to actually know God. Listen to this. This matters. This is the very next story that's about to happen. This matters what he's saying. Nobody actually gets God unless you listen to Jesus. What do the Jews, especially the Pharisees, think they know? They think they know
God,
yeah. And then he says, again, in context here, a very famous phrase to many of us. Some may even hear the hymn that we've got out of this in the background now. So come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, what's often missed in what he says there, very important, what he also says, anybody got a mark about an Old Testament line he slid in there? Some translations catch it, some don't. Anybody got a footnote, asterisk, italics, anything that draws you to a line he quoted?
Shall find rest.
Say again?
Shall find rest for you.
Yes! That is a line. Does your Bible tell you where it is, Troy?
It's in Jeremiah.
Yes! Go with me to Jeremiah 6 very quickly. Very quickly, because the clock's going to catch us. Jeremiah 6. I'm going to start reading in verse 16. I'm going to read quick because I got a ways to go yet, and it's already past 8. Verse 16 is where the actual line is, but what do we always do with Old Testament quotations? Read the context and watch what this context is. Thus says the Lord, stand by the roads and look and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it and find rest for your souls. But they said, what is this? What did they say? The essence of chapters 11 and 12. Those who will listen to Jesus get what? They get the rest, but what does the collectively, what do the people actually do when they are offered the rest? Yeah, and what's about to happen as you go into chapter 12? The Pharisees are going to do what? Slap back hard. Keep reading there. They said, we will not walk in it. I set watchmen over you, saying, pay attention to the sound of the trumpet. They said, we will not pay attention. Therefore, hear, O nations, and know, O congregation, what will happen to them. What does Jesus just say about foreign powers like Sodom or Tyre and Sidon? What would they have done if they'd gotten what you got? They would have listened. What's Jeremiah saying back in his day? The nations will listen. You're the guys who won't listen. Hear, O earth, behold, I am bringing disaster upon this people, the fruit of their devices, because they have not paid attention to my words, and as for my law, they have rejected it. What are Jesus and the Pharisees about to squabble over at the beginning of chapter 12? The law and what it means. What used to be is frankincense that comes from Sheba, and sweet came from a distant land. Your burnt offerings are not acceptable to me, nor your sacrifices pleasing me. Wait a second. Does this start to sound like Hosea again, too, where I desire chesed and not sacrifice? Again, it's not an either or. It's not the God that's saying, I don't want you to obey the rituals and the rules, but he's saying, with rituals and rules, will I be satisfied without loyalty? No. And in fact, without loyalty, will you rightly understand how to apply the law? No. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I will lay before this people stumbling blocks against which they shall stumble. Father and sons together, neighbor and friend shall perish. And he then prophesies of a coming destruction. And look at Jeremiah's role in this. And Jesus is very much in Matthew's gospel another Jeremiah, not just another Moses. We can talk about that another time. I have made you a tester of metals, verse 27, of my people, that you may know and test their ways. What is Jesus doing? Testing them. They are all stubbornly rebellious. They go about with slanders. What's going to happen in chapter 12 is Jesus is going to be viciously slandered. Jesus quotes a line at the end of chapter 11 and is the clue to what's going to happen in chapter 12 and what he is doing there. Okay? You can go back and read that more and meditate upon that in your own time and ponder those lines. By the way, chapter 6 then leads into chapter 7, Jeremiah's famous temple sermon when he prophesies of the coming destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Will Jesus use those lines again? In other words, will Jesus come back to this part of Jeremiah later in his ministry? Yes, he will, when he finally gets to Jerusalem and quotes lines from chapter 7 about the coming destruction to the people in Jerusalem about the temple. He's literally living out Jeremiah 6 and 7. Is what he's doing. All right. That said, back to chapter 12. Bell's going to catch me, but this is important. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. He and his disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain to eat. That was legal. In fact, the law commanded landowners and farmers to leave the edges of their fields for the hungry and for the traveler, because there was no Chick-fil-A to pull off at the next exit. That's not how it worked in the ancient world. And so a traveler who didn't bring enough food or ran out of food or had to go too far to keep fresh food, he was allowed to glean along the way. That's the mark of a righteous person. Somebody leaves that aspect of his food in place. His disciples, however, saw it. They said, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And he hits them back with two different ways. And this is important because this passage is often abused, again, with a worldly counterfeit of mercy, because he's about to quote Hosea 6 again. He's about to quote Hosea 6 again. Two things he hits back with them on when the Pharisees hit him. Verse 3, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? This is 1 Samuel 21. Go back and read on your own time. The bell's going to get me. How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor those who were with him, but only for the priests. Why does he bring that up? Now, commentators struggle with this. A lot of commentators will say, hey, when you read 1 Samuel chapter 21, in that text, and tell you that story, David was never condemned for eating it. And that's correct. The trick is, what does Jesus say here about the legality of what David did? Jesus explicitly says what? people love to come to this passage for situation ethics. If the need is great, you can violate God's law. That is not what this story is teaching. Jesus makes it very clear, even 1 Samuel 21 did not make it explicit. Jesus makes it very clear what David did is unlawful. He's not endorsing the violation of the law. What he's endorsing, or what he's why he's bringing this up then, is to the Pharisees. Did the Pharisees actually condemn David as a lawbreaker for this story?
No.
Which means the Pharisees are guilty of? Yeah. Okay. Because who is Jesus? He's another David on the run before he comes into his kingdom. In other words, he's living the David life, and you're condemning him for that. And then the next thing he does when he goes back and he says that, you know, the Sabbath priests, you know, are able to work on the Sabbath. They were allowed to, you know, were they literally able to do some stuff? Yes, they were. And so I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. If the priests can work on the Sabbath, can the God who inhabits the temple do what he wants with the Sabbath? Yes. I wish I had more time to talk about that, but I don't. But that's when he hits them again with, so go back again and learn what it means. I want loyalty, not sacrifice. Until you learn how to put God in your heart first, you will never rightly read the Bible. All right. Until next week.